ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
2,000 years ago, a Roman scholar named Pliny the Elder sailed out to the Greek island of Rhodes. Pliny was one of those scholars who was interested in absolutely everything, and he'd come there to see one of the marvels of the age, the Colossus of Rhodes. The Colossus was a bronze statue of the sun god Helios. It was a staggering 108 feet tall. It must have presented an astonishing vision to sailors coming into the harbour of Rhodes as the sun glinted off its metal surface. By the time Pliny arrived in Rhodes, the statue had long since toppled over. But, he said, even as it lies, it still excites our wonder and admiration. Few men can clasp the thumb in their arms, and its fingers are larger than most statues. The Colossus of Rhodes was one fixture on a list that was well known to the ancients of the seven wonders of the world, seven gargantuan monuments whose names ring down through the ages, monuments that fire the imagination and make people feel better simply for knowing they existed, even though only one of them still stands today. The British historian and broadcaster Bettany Hughes is here today. Bettany has written the story of these ancient wonders, and in doing so, she set herself the sublime task of travelling to the places where they were built, from Egypt to Mesopotamia. Bettany Hughes has climbed all over and around the stones of these monuments, all the while asking herself what the makers of these wonders were really trying to achieve. Her book is called The Seven Wonders of the Ancient World. Hello, Bettany.
Hello. How lovely to be here to chat to you.
It's wonderful to have you here, Bettany. The Colosseum in Rome, it's not on this list, but it's certainly a wonder in its own right. I remember that when I first took my son to see that in Rome, he was 14 years old. He was an Australian kid, never seen anything of the ancient world. And we were going down the street. We got to, I think it was the Via Cavour in Rome, and I just pointed to the Colosseum down the end of the road, and it had the effect you'd sort of absolutely want it to have. He literally staggered, Bettany. He was staggered at the sight of the Colosseum. I think this has to be true of all these wonders, isn't it? They have to be literally staggering.
They do, that's right. They are a list where size definitely matters. They are all gargantuan, and they're there to inspire awe and wonder. You know, that's one of the reasons that they were built. It's really interesting, actually, that you talk about the Colosseum, because on much later lists, the Colosseum does turn up as one of the ancient wonders. And, of course, its name was inspired by the original Colossus of Rhodes, because the Romans then built their own Colossus and then put it outside what was then the Flavian Amphitheatre, which came to be called the Colosseum. So the seven wonders get everywhere. But I'm glad your son was so impressed. It is indeed awesome to witness antiquity still living and standing today.
We call them wonders in English, but what word was used in Greek for them? And does it mean the same thing as wonder?
The original Greek was thaumata, which means a thing that is seen, and then it became thymata, which is like a sight. So the idea in the original ancient Greek list was very much that this was something that impressed you visually, and therefore something that would become word of mouth important.
Does the word thaumata sort of imply a dream made real, a dream you can actually touch, and that's one of the reasons why they are so staggering?
I think so. It is something to be amazed by. And certainly what the ancients talked about when they described these wonders is that they could hardly believe they were made by human hand. And I think we still feel that today. If you look at the Great Pyramid on the Giza Plateau, and indeed the other pyramids on the Giza Plateau, I mean, I can't remember how many times I've been now, but I'm never not gobsmacked, because they almost feel impossible, which is, of course, why, I'm sorry if there are any conspiracy theorists out there listening, it's why people say that they were built by aliens. They couldn't have been built by humans. They were definitely built by humans. I've actually gone down underneath the pyramid into the bedrock itself and seen the chisel marks of human hands. So, yeah, they were definitely made by humans. But, yeah, you're right. They are of exceptional ambition and accomplishment. So, which is why I think sometimes we almost don't think they're real. You know, if you talk about the Seven Wonders, I think sometimes people imagine this is a sort of mythological list or a fantasy list, or it's a list of wonders scattered across the globe. But these were seven very, very, very real buildings, all of which survive in some form, with a possibly one exception, and very real places that were visited by very real women and men.
Now, you talk about how there were many such lists in the ancient world. Some of the monuments were in, others were out. But tell me about the blueprints for these wonder lists that you're operating on that was found attached to an Egyptian mummy.
Yeah, that's right. I know. Well, this whole process of writing this book has been an adventure from beginning to end. So you're exactly, absolutely spot on. So the earliest extant evidence that we have for this Seven Wonders list is a fragment of papyrus, which was used to mummify a body in central Egypt on the banks of the River Nile. It's very fragmentary, this one. But what we can tell from it is that it's part of a thing that's come to be called the Latakuli Alexandrini, so a compendium that was written in ancient Alexandria. And it was a list of lists. So it was a kind of BuzzFeed of its day. So we hear about the Seven Wonders, but we also hear about the Seven Best mountains, the seven finest springs, the seven most amazing generals and artists in antiquity. And that really tells us something about the rationale of the age that created the Seven Wonders list, because this is a time after Alexander the Great, and it's almost like this is a world that really wants to rationalise things.
So this is a list of the best of everything, but I have to ask, what's it doing attached to a mummy? I mean, you're unwrapping a mummy and there's a list there that says, you know where you should go on your holidays, but here. Why was it attached to a mummy?
Well, again, you see, it's really interesting that, because the writing on it isn't particularly smart. So there's actually a possibility that the original papyrus, and we're talking like 2,300 years ago, 2,200 years ago, was being copied out possibly by a student as a kind of writing exercise. So, you know, people going like, oh, you know, like you have to kind of recite your times tables. They had to recite the seven wonders of the ancient world. So it was probably sort of almost like scrap paper. And then that paper, the papyrus, then gets reused in something called cartonnage, which is basically a sort of papyrus papier-mâché, which is used to surround mummified human remains in ancient Egypt. So all kinds of things are appearing from these cartonnage documents. Greek plays, snippets of gospels that haven't yet been seen, lost poems of the ancient Greek poetess Sappho. So they're incredibly exciting and rich archaeological materials to work with. And thank goodness this one survived, because this tells us that, you know, it's the oldest Seven Wonders list.
You mentioned Alexander the Great there, the great Macedonian conqueror that set out from the Greek mainland and conquered half the world and ended up in going as far as India. What connection does he have to each one of these wonders?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the lists were made sort of almost in his image. So Alexander the Great, as you said, this extraordinary, ferocious warrior who died young, he would have visited a number of them. So we know that he had connections with the ancient site of Olympia, where there was a statue of Zeus. We know that he went to Egypt. But it was the fact that this list was created, in some ways, is almost a kind of homage to Alexander, because Alexander was an extraordinary warrior. He was also a man who loved rationale and reason. The philosopher Aristotle was his tutor, and Aristotle was very keen on a kind of taxonomy of things, kind of making lists of lists. And so because Alexander conquered huge swathes of Europe, of North Africa, of Asia, there was sort of left behind this sense that this is what the world should do. It should rationally approach things. And this is one of the reasons that all these lists were drawn up in Alexandria, the city that was given Alexander the Great's name. So he both had a physical connection to them, and it's almost like his psychology is one of the reasons that the lists were made in the first place.
Now, you mentioned there was lists of seven wonders, seven kings, seven rivers. Why seven? Why not eight or six or two or three or 10 wonders?
The number seven in the ancient world had this inherent symbolic, magical, mystical power. And there are a number of reasons for that. the ancients thought that it encapsulated the seven elements of earth, so earth, air, wind and fire, and the three elements of the heavens, so the sun, the moon and the stars. So the idea was that sort of all of the cosmos was, and all cosmic and universal power was contained in this number seven. Mathematically, it's an exciting number as well. I had a fascinating conversation with somebody just after I'd written the book. I was saying, you tell me as a mathematician, why is it so special? And he said, oh, well, one reason is that it's the only shape that you can't make with a compass and a flat rule, which were the tools that the ancients had with them. So whether they sort of felt it was somehow kind of divinely inspired. But seven was a number that really counted. And by putting these into a list of seven, you gave them their own authority, as they become greater than just the sum of the whole, because they are thought to have, as I said, this sort of magical power. I love the Greeks. You know, people will know I've made a lot of television programmes about the Greeks. I've written a lot of books about the Greeks. I spend a lot of time in Greece. I adore that culture. But they invent the word history, and they're very good at writing themselves into it. So the ancient Greeks will say, well, we invented this idea of the list of seven. But actually, it goes right the way back to the Middle and Near East, where you get these seven demonic powers and these seven heroes that defeat them. There are mythical cities with seven gates. And of course, the idea of the Dance of the Seven Veils, which we're told was something that the biblical character Salome did, that idea starts right back in the Middle East as well, when the goddess Inanna Ishtar, who's the kind of great-great-grandmother of Venus and Aphrodite, takes off seven veils as she enters the seven gates of the eternal world.
And there are seven heavens as well. And would somehow, and I don't know why, Benny, but to talk about eight wonders of the world would be lame. And I can't say why. Just cannot say why.
No, it's fascinating, isn't it? And again, when I've been on the road talking about this book, this delightful gentleman from Wales came up to me, lovely, elegant, older man. I think he was probably a farmer. And he said to me, you know, he'd got very depressed during lockdown at the time of COVID, unexpectedly. And he found that the only thing that made him calm and feel positive about the world was lying in bed at night and reciting to himself lists of seven wonderful things, you know, seven things, seven beautiful plants, seven beautiful trees. And he said he just automatically went to that number seven. So, yeah, we do seem to have a kind of connection to it as a species.
The pyramids, proceeding through time as you have in your book. The first is the pyramids. As you say, 4,500 years old. Do you remember your first encounter with the Great Pyramid at Giza?
Yeah, gosh, I do. I travelled overnight and then woke up and just saw it. I just couldn't believe it. This is a building that's made of 2.3 million limestone blocks. It's still the heaviest building ever constructed on Earth. And the perfection of its geometry is extraordinary. And if you imagine it as it would have been in its day, built by the great King Khufu as this kind of giant resurrection machine so that he could be buried inside and then travel to join the stars and the universe, it would have been faced with gleaming white, highly polished limestone. So it looks impressive now. I mean, it would have looked like a kind of sci-fi construction back in the Bronze Age. So
how would it have looked to people living in the Bronze Age?
Well, they'd have been bright white, so highly polished was the limestone, it would almost have looked like gleaming metal. And then on the Great Pyramid itself, there was a capstone capped with electrum, which is a sort of a natural combination of silver and gold. So that would have gleamed out as well. It would have captured the sunlight of that extraordinary country of Egypt. And I think if you have woken up in the desert or gone to sleep there, if you look at how the sun appears when it rises or sets through cloud, it kind of creates what we now call kind of fingers of God, but creates a natural pyramid in the sky. And I'm sure that's no coincidence. I'm sure for the ancients, they were trying to kind of replicate the extraordinary glory of nature. And the whole pyramid project was created to try to connect humans to the cosmos, to the universe, but also closer to the river. So the River Nile once almost lapped the feet of the pyramid.
So it would have been reflected in the water.
It would have been reflected in the water, yeah, exactly.
So would that whole area have been green? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So not a desert. There would have been tamarisk trees and clover and hippos, baby hippos in the river, kind of munching lotus flowers. So it would have been completely idyllic.
You said there it was a kind of a resurrection machine for the king, Khufu.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they believed that life never ended, but they believed that life only never ended if all the correct funerary rituals were seen to, and that meant mummifying the King Khufu's body so that he could be perfectly preserved. His body would be mummified. It would then be wrapped in linen, wrapped in shrouds, buried within a kind of nest of coffins, processed into the pyramid tomb itself. Incredibly excitingly, we know from frescoes from slightly later pyramids and tombs of the kind of musicians who'd have been there at those processions of the bodies into the tombs. They're exactly the same as some of the instruments that are still used in the Egyptian Orthodox Church. So we can actually hear the sound that would have accompanied the king into his burial place. There's probably incense would have been used, a huge procession of priests, and then he was laid to rest within the tomb. Obviously, he's no longer there. The pyramid's been robbed, so there are no treasures inside, unless, and this is what's so exciting about archaeology and history, unless there is a new discovery. So already during the writing of the book, a new passageway was discovered above the king's chamber. There's a great void above it, which...
How can these things be still being discovered? How come we don't know this already? I mean, we've been looking at the pyramid for a long while now, Bethany.
I know.
How are they just now discovering new extensions and rooms inside?
I know. I mean, it's completely nuts, isn't it? Well, it's just because it's such a solid building, it's very difficult to penetrate. So it's only now, actually, that we're getting the tech and the radar that's allowing us to go both inside the pyramid and to read it. There's a process called moanography that's being used to read inside the pyramid. But I know it's so exciting, isn't it? It's not impossible that the thing that we go into with a giant red granite sarcophagus that is said to be the king's chamber, that that's a kind of decoy, and that Khufu's still buried further up.
You see, this is the joy of this to me, is that 4,500 years later, we're still finding out radical and important new things about the pyramid. Tell me about this new evidence that's come to light quite recently on how these, particularly the Great Pyramid, was constructed in the first place. Because, you know, for years people were saying, well, it must have been aliens because no human hand can construct such a thing. What do we know now?
Slowly, we're jigsaw puzzling together the evidence. There's incredibly exciting evidence that is just emerging, which is actually telling us how the pyramid was built. And, you know, you can probably tell from the excitement in my voice, this doesn't happen often in an archaeologist or a historian's lifetime. So on the Red Sea, there's a current archaeological dig of a port. And the port has behind it, this is dating back to the time of the pyramid and just before, behind it there are 100 or so human-made caves, sort of storage magazines, some of which are 100 feet deep. And in there we're discovering all kinds of incredible things. So ship's ropes from the time of the building of the pyramid, leather shoes belonging to the sailors, anchors inscribed with the names of the boatsmen who sailed, and, wait for it, 1,000 fragments of papyri, and on those papyri are written a kind of logbook journal account of the building of the pyramid.
Good God!
I know. I mean, you know, you could not make it up. And how the material was shipped up, and who was involved, and how many people, and, you know, how long it took, and all. So it's so exciting, which is, again, another reason that I know it wasn't built by aliens, because there we have the datable evidence from 4,500 years ago.
And yet, for all of that, it seems to be as much a resurrection machine. The pyramid seems to be a spaceship of its own. It seems to be something that was going to project King Khufu up to the heavens,
wasn't it? Well, yes, that's right. Yeah, absolutely right. This idea that his car, his spirit or his soul would rise to the heavens, and that he would be reincarnated and then would live eternally. So you can see why people get a bit overexcited about it. But we're an incredible planet, you know, and we think up incredible things. You don't need to have an alien to create the idea of a spaceship.
The second of your wonders in time are the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. This is, if anything, the most famous of the seven wonders. When you say the seven wonders of the world, people go, oh, yeah, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. But the most elusive. First of all, though, before we get into their elusiveness, what do we know about these gardens and what they looked like and how they were even hanging? That's always a thing that's bewildered me, Bethany.
Well, we do have a lot of contemporary and slightly later accounts of them. A lot of people write about the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. They describe how lush they were. They describe the fact that they were built sort of surmounting the city walls. How I imagine them and how they're described is almost like a series of massive window boxes stacked one on top of the other so that they would have resembled a kind of mountain. And we're told that one of the reasons they were designed this way was to resemble the mountains of King Nebuchadnezzar the Great's homesick wife who'd come from the kind of Median lands and she was missing her mountains there. What are also described are these really complex watering systems. So screws, the kind of original Archimedes screw that would have wound water up from the river Euphrates.
So the fact that they were hanging, do we imagine like vast planter boxes or were they sort of terraced? How do we imagine them?
Well, I think because a lot of bitumen was used, and bitumen was used as a waterproofing material, which suggests that you almost do have these kind of giant planters that would be lined so that they were waterproof, so that the not just the plants, I mean, I think people have to imagine the scale, the trees, the whole trees that were planted in the hanging gardens could be sufficiently watered and kept alive, because as we all know, there's nothing more depressing than a dying garden. You know, there's nothing more depressing.
I live with them all my life, Bethany.
Me too. Yeah, me too. It's just, I don't know, you know, I've not got green fingers. I wish I had. But yeah, so they were very well watered. They'd have been exotic. There would have been pavilions of pleasure of all kinds amongst the gardens as well. So we have a lot of descriptions of them. But of course, the frustrating thing is we don't have irrefutable hard archaeological evidence for exactly where they were and exactly what they looked like in their day, which is again about 2,600, 2,500 years ago.
Now, Herodotus, the father of history, almost certainly went to Babylon and he wrote extensively about it. This was well after the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar. He makes no mention of these fabulous gardens. There's no archaeological evidence for them, but then everything was made out of mud bricks then, and so it may have well just, you know, melted all away. So there is one theory which says that they never existed and they were some kind of composite fantasy. But then there's another theory advanced by historian Stephanie Daly that says they weren't even in Babylon at all.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There's a possibility that they were 100 miles north in the city of Nineveh, which is within the wider region of Babylonia. And Stephanie Daly writes a very persuasive monograph on this.
Yes.
I wonder if something interesting is going on. So also, this Assyrian king, Nebuchadnezzar the Great, was a Babylonian king in Babylon. Sennacherib was an Assyrian king in Nineveh, which is close to modern-day Mosul. And Sennacherib also describes the gardens in his palace. He also describes, as Nebuchadnezzar does, that as a king, one of the things that he did was not just invade territories, enslave people, take over land. He was so powerful, he could ship entire forests back into his kingdom. And for both of them, this was something it was really important to state and to do, because unlike the ancient Egyptians, who were all about their connection to nature, once you get to the Iron Age, when you get iron technology, so iron weapons and also iron agricultural instruments, you can control the earth in a much more effective way. And this is something that those kings were really keen that everybody knew about. And they put these inscriptions up saying, I brought cedars of Lebanon and I scattered them in the river as if they were matchsticks. And, you know, Sennacherib describes all these extraordinary plants that he's brought in from his military campaigns. So there could be a chance that actually there were not one but two hanging gardens of Babylon, and that this was just something that great kings of the age did to prove their might and their main.
The gardens are the most elusive of the wonders of the world. Why do you think they have stuck in the world's mind so strongly?
Well, maybe for that very reason, because they're elusive, because they have a slight aura of fantasy and dream and this kind of paradisical sense about them. We can create in our minds whatever we want to imagine to be the most perfect, beautiful hanging garden. And it's so interesting that you say that, because almost without exception, people list of the Seven Wonders, they list the Hanging Gardens of Babylon first. And yet that's the most elusive. But I think that's why, because people can imagine it, that, you know, they're not being told what it's like. They can let their mind wander and dream a little to imagine ourselves in that most exquisite of botanical expressions.
for so long in the ancient world, Babylon was the city. It was the very idea of a perfect city. It was so much bigger than any other city that had ever been there before. It's spoken of with that sense of awe. And also, of course, the Hebrews thought of it as a place of terrible wickedness. It was a fascinating, compelling place, but it was made out of mud bricks. And so I think Tom Holland says it sort of melted away like a chocolate cake in the rain.
Yeah.
And during the Iraq War, apparently the US Army was using the archaeological site as a huge place to park their tanks. So is there anything left of ancient Babylon, Bethany?
Well, there are fragments, and there are fragments in other places. So the extraordinary coloured walls of Babylon, these walls that were also described, as you said right at the beginning, by Herodotus, for instance, and many others, which are exquisite. I mean, they're glazed, tiled walls, bright blue with roaring lions and lamassu, which are these sort of dragon-like creatures stalking across them. And they're mind-blowing, and fragments of these still exist. There are also panels in Istanbul Archaeological Museum, for instance. So you can see them. So we know that those brightly coloured walls existed. And I just think never say never with archaeology. There's an incredibly brave journalist called Namat Korsan who travelled to Mosul and went underneath the ancient city, underneath the ancient palace, really kind of risking his life to do so, and took photographs of these underground water channels, which are also highly decorated with incredible carvings. We can see those. So those are definitely representing there's something really interesting going on with water supplies in Sennacherib's palace. So I just think that one day we'll find them. And I'm heading out to Iraq next year to try to do exactly that.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Find out more about the Conversations podcast. Just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
You mentioned there how people were aware of these seven wonders at the time the list was compiled. Was there a time when ancient tourists could have visited all seven of these wonders?
Yeah, absolutely there was. And we know it's something that people did, because if you look at them on a map, they ring the Mediterranean. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon are a slight outlier because they're further into Asia, into the Middle East. But all of them are actually pretty accessible by boat. And what's really fascinating about these ancient lists is that a number of the lists weren't just lists. They were basically travel guides. There's a particular guy called Antipater of Sidon and another called Philo of Byzantium, another one called Callimachus of Cyrene. And if you read some of these, they sort of say things like, oh, you know, if you're going to see the Colossus of Rhodes, don't stop at that particular port because you'll get robbed and, you know, all your luggage will get nicked and there are pirates around that bay. So there were these very, very practical guides that were given to people, which is one of the reasons that we know so much about them, because they were written about by such a variety. And that carried on even sort of into the early medieval world. We have this fantastic woman who should be a household name. I would love to have met her, called Egeria, who was possibly a nun or a lay sister. She came from Portugal, and she travelled through the Holy Land by herself. Hers was a sort of religious mission. And she gives us these incredibly detailed, this is from the 4th century AD, these incredibly detailed descriptions of the Great Pyramid of Giza, for instance. Although what's quite interesting about her is that she's the person who says, oh, this wasn't a kind of pagan pyramid. These were actually the granaries of Joseph from the Bible.
Oh,
and,
right.
And that's why they came known as granaries. And ever since then, you know, if you go into the St. Mark's Basilica in Venice, for instance, and look up at the incredible mosaics, there are the pyramids represented as granaries, with Joseph standing outside with sheaves of wheat and these kind of little windows inside them. So some of the visitors give us a slightly false impression of what they were like. But yeah, absolutely. People went to them as ancient and medieval tourists.
Third on your list is the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus, which was built sometime around 550 BCE. Now, this Ephesus was and is on the sun-kissed Aegean coast. There was a sacred grove there. When you go there today, do you still find it an atmospheric place to visit?
Incredibly atmospheric. There isn't a lot of the temple itself left, but there's a sort of single standing column, usually with a stork making its nest on top. So this was a place originally where the sea met fresh water, where there were springs. And that's always a magical combination. It's still very marshy, so it's, you know, full of the sound of frogs and toads. And, you know, I do think there is something intangibly special about it, because it was built on a kind of fault line. So it was a building that suffered from earthquake damage throughout its history. And the architects kept on trying to do all these special measures of putting in kind of sheep's fleeces and packing it with charcoal to try to absorb some of the water and deal with the earthquake, but the kind of earthquake impact. But they refused to move the temple. So it's really interesting because you're building it on a floodplain and on a fault line, but they would not move the temple to somewhere more sensible.
Oh, it must be here. Yes, it has to be here. So they sense something magical and beautiful about the place then.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
So if we imagine it looking like a classic Greek temple like the Parthenon, what made it so particularly wondrous in its time?
It was twice the size of the Parthenon in Athens, for instance. You know,
twice?
Yes, twice as big, you know. And if you think about that, the Parthenon in Athens on the top of the Acropolis is pretty massive, but this was double that size. It was the sort of mothership of all Greek temples. In a way, most Greek temples that we imagine, and then the copycat Greek temples that are, you know, are still being produced in the modern day, when you see those lovely columns and pediments and buildings, it all came from the inspiration of the Temple of Artemis. So this was the first stone-built, colonnaded temple of its kind. And everybody tried to imitate it through time. So
the Parthenon was a copy of it, a pale copy, if you like, yes, of this temple then.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, I mean, we're being rude about the Parthenon, if you say it was a pale copy.
People wouldn't see both when, oh, I've seen better.
Yeah, exactly. It was less ambitious. It was less ambitious.
So it was dedicated to Artemis, the goddess Artemis, the goddess of the hunt. Is this the aspect of her that's being celebrated in this temple, though, Bethany?
Well, she is a goddess of the hunt, but she's an Eastern Artemis. So if you look at the sculptures of Artemis from this temple, I mean, Google them after you've listened to me talk. You will.
They're
pretty unforgettable, aren't they? So this isn't a kind of wafty, pretty goddess with sort of, you know, curly hair and a little tiny, tiny diaphanous.
She's not Aphrodite. No, she's not.
She's not Aphrodite. So she's standing ferociously straight, and on her chest are 30 or so things that look like breasts, which is why she's called the polymastic Artemis. If you look closer, they aren't actually breasts. There aren't any nipples there. Some people think they're sacks of honey. Some people think they're bull's testicles, but whatever they are.
Wow.
I know, you know, like, hold that thought in your mind.
But are they meant to suggest fecundity? I mean, are we meant to think of them as being like breasts or as symbols of her fecundity?
Yeah, I definitely. I mean, you know, we'd be sort of crazy if we didn't think that whoever sculpted that thought, these are going to look like she's got 30 or so bosoms on her. But I think it's a richer visual impression than that, because it's exactly as you're saying. It's saying, oh, she's fecund in so many different ways. This goddess Artemis was thought to be so sort of sexy and powerful that she could just kind of squeeze life out of her. You know, she didn't need to have sex with any creature, with a human or anybody else, in order to generate. She could just, like, produce life. And that is what's being celebrated there, is this mistress of nature, really, and of Mother Earth. So you've got these kind of extraordinary, whatever they are, protuberances on her chest. She's, in some versions, she's surrounded with signs of the zodiac, with monsters, with goats, with cows. You know, it's an incredible sort of encrusted image. And on the top of her head, in one of the sculptures, is the Temple of Artemis. That's her hat and her crown is the temple. So it was thought to be so important that it was literally surmounting this divinity. It'd be sort of like the equivalent of a halo, but the halo was the temple.
You've got a quote there from that classical tourist you mentioned earlier, Antipater of Sidon, who said, "I have set eyes on the very wall of lofty Babylon, supporting a chariot road, and the statue of Zeus in Olympia, and the hanging gardens and the Colossus, and the huge labour of the steep pyramids. But when I saw the temple of Artemis reaching up to the clouds, these other marvels dimmed, they lost their brilliance, and I declared, 'Look, the sun has never shone on anything that can compare to this.'" Doesn't this feel like agony that we can't clap eyes on this thing ourselves, Bethany?
Oh, it does. And just on the kind of physical impression of the place, but also just the atmosphere of and the experience of the people who went there, because this was a temple that was actively provided sanctuary for refugees who sought the protection of the goddess. And so many refugees went there that people fleeing, you know, political persecution or religious persecution, or if you had a kind of just cause and the priests took you in, you could claim sanctuary in the temple.
So this is quite different from the pyramid, for example, because that's really only a house for a king, isn't it?
Yes.
This is a place for everyone.
Yes, exactly. Somewhere where all worshippers could go. So therefore, it would have had a much more democratic atmosphere. Later, Romans were complaining in a typical Roman NIMBY way and saying, "Well, we don't like the fact there are so many dormitories of refugees here." They can be heartless sometimes, the Romans.
Right. But I mean, right, no riffraff around
exactly,
here. That's
exactly,
right.
Exactly. But isn't that interesting that it would have meant that to people, again, to, you know, 2,500 years ago?
Fourth of the wonders on your list is the statue of Zeus at Olympia, built around 430 BCE. How would someone, an ancient person from the ancient world, what would they have seen as they approached this statue of Zeus?
I mean, again, so awe-inspiring. Zeus is the king of the gods. He's been worshipped. He is the Olympian Zeus being worshipped in his sanctuary at Olympia. Olympia, progenitor of the Olympic Games, was all about competition and power and fighting and winning out. And you've got this god who's in charge of fighting and power and winning out. So it would have been, I think people would have approached it with real trepidation. The statue itself was seated. It was over 40 feet high, even seated. So again, it contained this kind of incredible power of potential. Just imagine people thinking, "Oh, what would Zeus be like if he stood up? He'd have unroofed the temple," made out of a ton of gold, a ton of hippopotamus ivory, crystal, beautifully sculpted crystals and flowers and bronze decorations. So just awesome. And then to cap it all, reflected in a giant pool of olive oil. So it would have seemed to be double height. It was a real kind of coup de theatre. And of course, surrounded by incense, as these ancient temples and sculptures were. And you'd have been coming to there, you know, for pilgrimage for the Olympic Games. Between 50 and 100,000 people travelling to visit. That all sounds very romantic, but we actually know that there was a huge fly problem at Olympia because there were so many people travelling who were sweating and pooing and weeing and, you know, everywhere that there was this, like, infestation of flies. So Zeus at Olympia was also known as Zeus Apomeios, so Zeus the fly averter. So, yeah, you know, a kind of mixture of amazing and pretty rank, I think. And what you have to remember about the ancient gods is that people, first of all, there was no question that they were real. You know, it'd be like asking if the sea was real. You know, they're kind of course they're real. And they could come to life at any point. They could inhabit a statue or an ear of wheat or an apple tree. You never knew when they were going to manifest themselves. And he would have glowered as if it was said that his face looked as though it had thunder within it.
Now mate, the statue, you're right, was most likely taken down and dragged off to Constantinople, the Eastern Roman Empire capital, which we now know as Istanbul. Do we know what happened to it there?
We do. And it's really tragic. So it made the journey, you know, that is quite a journey by land and sea to, as you say, what we now call Istanbul, Constantinople.
I mean, it's a Christian city. Were they going to not lop its head off and put an emperor's head on top or something? Or what were they going to do
with
it?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's a Christian city, but it's basically Rome has just moved 800 miles east in Constantinople, and they loved ancient statues and they collected them. There was a sort of, they had these kind of giant outdoor museums, partly as well because it was almost like they were bringing that power in, they were controlling it. But so they didn't take the head off, as far as we know. It was displayed in the palace of a eunuch called Lausos, but unfortunately in the 5th century there was a terrible fire which destroyed that statue and all kinds of other beautiful statues of the goddess Hera of Samos, for instance. So yeah, so really tragically it burnt to the ground.
Number 5 on your list is the mausoleum of Halicarnassus, built around about 351 BC. Where was this city, Halicarnassus? What do we know it as today?
So it's Bodrum, modern-day Bodrum, which is a kind of holiday and party city on the Turkish coast. It was a city that was the centre of the Carian kingdom. They were establishing a new centre for themselves in Halicarnassus, rebuilding the city. And the mausoleum of Halicarnassus was the tomb of their great king, Mausolus.
So that's where we get the word mausoleum from, was the king Mausolus?
Yeah, absolutely. All mausoleums are named after this king.
It was also for his wife and sister. I'll say that again, wife and sister, Artemisia as well. Tell me a bit about her. She seems to have caught your interest even more than old King Mausolus here.
Yeah, she does. Well, I love Artemisia. I mean, partly because she's of very good stock. So she's descended. This is Artemisia the Second, and she's descended from Artemisia the First, who was also a Carian queen, who was a female admiral. There are not that many female admirals in the history of the world. And she was a female admiral 2,500 years ago. And Artemisia finished off the mausoleum and seems to have been responsible in large part for its building. And she is also buried there. So really,
so should we call it the Artemisium, should we?
We should call it the Artemisium. Exactly right. So they were called the Queens of Caria. And this mausoleum of Halicarnassus, again, an extraordinary construction. I imagine it a bit like a sort of crazy wedding cake with a little bit of everything going on in tiers. There was a pyramid on the top. There were panels representing battles with Amazons. It would have been brightly coloured. There was something that slightly resembled the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus in terms of colonnades, probably surmounted by this extraordinary sculpture, stone sculpture of Artemis herself, Artemisia.
And torn down like so many of these wonders by a bloody earthquake. Honestly, it's just,
I know,
breaks your heart. This, doesn't it?
I know, it does. It does. You know, it's the problem of that seismic zone. So, yeah, torn down by an earthquake, but also pilfered by crusading knights who were building a new castle in Bodrum. So there are little bits of the mausoleum of Halicarnassus that have been physically built into the stonework.
Number 6 is the Colossus of Rhodes that I spoke about earlier, the gigantic statue of the sun god Helios, thought to have been 108 foot tall. I think a lot of those ancient pictures have the Colossus straddling different points on the harbour. That couldn't have happened, could it? How should we imagine the Colossus?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So we'd love to. People so want there to be boats going in sort of between the legs of their Colossus.
I do too.
I know. Yes, it would. Sadly, engineers tell us that would have been physically impossible. And actually, it seems that it was an Italian lawyer who visited in the 14th century who dreamt up this idea of it straddling the harbours. But what's really interesting, and it's one of the reasons why I can't write about history unless I go to visit it, to sort of physically inhabit the space where it happened, is if you sail into the island of Rhodes and you look up at the top of the old town where the ancient city was, up to the sanctuary of Helios, the sun god, and this was a sculpture of the great sun god Helios, and imagine a 108 foot tall sculpture up there, then actually it would almost have looked as though it was straddling the two harbours beneath, the military harbour and the commercial harbour. So it was almost like a kind of optical illusion. So I think that's what's going on.
It was found to be lying on the ground by Pliny the Elder when he went there. It didn't stand up for very long, did it, before it was toppled by an earthquake once again. Isn't that right?
Once again. Stood either 50 or 57 years. I mean, you know, that's terrible, isn't it? So
yeah. Short. But I don't really need a reason for such a thing to exist in the world. I'm glad it was there. Was there any reason for it to exist other than its pure fabulousness?
Well, possibly a very beautiful reason. So there'd been a terrible siege of Rhodes. This is, again, after Alexander the Great has died. There's this kind of competition for power in the Hellenistic world. And an abominable... I mean, sieges are terrible at the best of times, but this is one of the ones where there was appalling suffering. And basically, kind of sensible people stepped in and said, hang on a second, what are we doing? This is just death and destruction. You know, it's a zero-sum end game. And diplomatic treaty was reached. And what we're told is that the siege weapons, the siege engines and the weapons from the siege from both sides were melted down in order to create this giant bronze statue. You know, we don't know whether or not that's true, but it's a huge amount of bronze to work with. So it does make sense. So it almost is, we should think of it as a kind of a testament to the power of diplomacy and resolving disputes peacefully.
It lasted a while, lying on the ground as it did, but after it was conquered by the Arabs in the, what was it, the 7th century or thereabouts?
Yes, or 8th, yes.
It was melted down into coins by a Jewish scrap dealer, atomised into billions of little pieces that circulated through the early medieval world. That's a very poignant end for the atomisation of the Colossus of Rhodes, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I know it is. And, you know, again, how are the mighty fallen? And that's something that, that, you know, the beautiful Ozymandias poem is something that I thought about a lot when I was writing this book, that we create these things, we love them, you know, they achieve, and then time or Mother Nature or human greed takes them over. But I guess that's also part of the reality of existence, isn't it? That you know, we rise and we fall, and it is a very poignant idea, you know. But again, I always deal with history and archaeology positively. Maybe somebody squirreled away some you know, a digit, one of the fingernails of the Colossus, which will turn up in some archaeological dig somewhere. It is not impossible, as I said. You know, if we're finding the papyrus that tells us how the Great Pyramid was built,
yes,
then who knows what's going to emerge? There is absolutely hope.
The seventh and last of the wonders is the lighthouse at Alexandria, the Pharos Lighthouse at Alexandria, built in 297 BC. And just off the top of my head, I'm just thinking now that the distance between the construction of that lighthouse and us is pretty much the same as the distance between that lighthouse and the pyramids going back 4,500 years ago. So there's a huge, huge span of time here. I'm thinking that a lighthouse is very nice, but it would have to be pretty big to be included on the list of seven wonders, wouldn't it?
Oh, my God. And this was huge. So this is three times the size of the Colossus of Rhodes. It's probably about 480 feet high.
Dear God, was it the first skyscraper, I wonder?
Yeah. I think it absolutely was. And there's a kind of brilliant bit of evidence for that, that there's one of my favourite characters from antiquity is a guy called Lucian Samostata, who has such a wicked sense of humour. And he writes the world's first sci-fi novel. And we're talking about, you know, in the ancient world. And he describes an ancient Greek astronaut who flies up to space and looks down and recognises that it's planet Earth beneath him, because he can see both the Colossus of Rhodes and the Lighthouse of Alexandria. So, you know, they'd come to sort of be thought about as so extraordinary. They were the thing that defined the planet itself. It was a working lighthouse as well. It cast a beam, probably with a permanently burning flame reflected against beaten metal of some kind. It was highly decorated, again, with these... Alexandria loved these sort of moving statues and automata. So it would have been the most extraordinary beacon. And again, something that was talked about as far away as China, you know. So in Chinese documents, we get these descriptions of the Lighthouse of Alexandria.
I mean, I imagine it's lit as a big kind of pyre, like the lights of Gondor or something in Lord of the Rings or something. But were there mirrors in it to reflect the light and magnify the signal coming off the lighthouse?
What we think is, because obviously they had glass then, and they also had silver, so you could kind of silver back mirrors. I think it's most likely to be beaten metal. They describe it as Chinese steel, as how they describe it. But it would have been, you know, it would definitely have kind of reached out. And lighthouses and beacons were a form of communication in the ancient world. So they had their own kind of Morse code that would have been tapped out. So it would have been a way that messages could get across North Africa and the Mediterranean too.
And have you seen its remnants? Are there remnants still, stones of the Great Lighthouse in Alexandria in Egypt today?
There are, and I've walked on them and I've touched them and, you know, oh my gosh, so lucky. So there was a later fort built on the footprint of the lighthouse in the Ottoman period. So that's itself is a historic building. But you can see some of the old stones from the original lighthouse built into sort of the lintels and onto some of the doorways and the thresholds that you cross. And if you look down into the Bay of Alexandria, there beneath the waves are blocks of stone from the lighthouse itself. So, you know, it's very romantic and very exciting.
Well, I really have to, apart from writing a wonderful book, I have to really credit you with coming up with an idea that would take you to such wonderful places. That I mean, there are worse. I mean, it's not like you're writing about the six worst gulags in the Soviet Union here, are you, Bethany? This is a fun book to write. I want to bring in, I hope you can forgive me for this, but I'm going to bring in a little bit of Australian chauvinism in here, which is on any list of the modern wonders of the world, I think you'd have to include the Sydney Opera House there, which is an extraordinary building to visit, to see a performance in. And it does strike you as a wonder, the way it catches the light of the water, its extraordinary shape, the size of the damn thing, its position. It's incredibly beautiful, and can be literally staggering if you see it by arriving by boat or by ferry for the first time. And here's the thing I find when I'm going to the Opera House, every time I've gone to the Opera House, it makes you feel two things at the same time. It makes you feel like your life is tiny and you're this tiny little insignificant dot. But at the same time, the building feels like a great big present that was made just for you. Do you know what I'm talking about here? Do you get that feeling as well in such places?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's the wonder of wonders. Because if we wonder at something, we engage with it, we connect with it. And if we connect with something, we understand it. And if we understand something, we care about it. So they're monuments that encourage us to care, about the lives of others, about our own lives, about our own place in the world. And that is what wonder and awe and amazement does, you know. And we would be an impoverished world if we didn't have wonder within it. So I think you're absolutely right, you know. And, you know, I've got to confess, though, I am coming next year, but I've never seen the Sydney Opera House in the flesh. So,
oh my God.
I know. I'll have to have a look at the Sydney Opera House, because people always ask me which is the eighth wonder of the world. And maybe once I've experienced it in the flesh, I can put that in.
The people who built the seven ancient wonders, they did so often, of course, at enormous cost to their treasury. And, of course, at the cost of tens, hundreds, thousands of slaves gave their lives in the construction of these places. But they built it because they wanted their names to ring out through the ages. And here we are, Bethany, you and me, talking about Khufu and Nebuchadnezzar and Artemisia. It worked, didn't it?
It worked. We still feel that these things matter to us. Exactly as you said, we're spending time thinking about them, talking about them. It's almost as though now scientists tell us something very exciting that we carry with us, not just memory, not just genetic memory, but symbolic inheritance. And because our mothers and fathers and grandfathers and grandmothers going right back talked about these things, they've never been forgotten, we're actually born with a sense that they matter, that these are symbols that we need to carry with us. So we sort of have the seven wonders within us, and they do remind us what we can do when we collaborate together. So long may this be a world full of wonderful things.
And it's been such a pleasure speaking with you, Bethany. Thank you so much.
So lovely to chat.
Bethany Hughes's book is called The Seven Wonders of the Ancient World. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.